This is The View from 22 from The Spectator. Subscribe from just £1 a week at spectator.co.uk.
Welcome to The View from 22 podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman, assistant editor of The Spectator. In this episode, we'll be discussing the EU referendum. As our political editor James Forsyth reveals in this week's magazine, the In campaign has a new strategy. They're unsure they can win the economic arguments, so instead, they will ask whether Britain really wants to go it alone in a dangerous and uncertain world. David Cameron will say Brexit would compromise our security, given the threat of ISIS, Vladimir Putin, and organised crime. I'll be joined by James and by The Spectator's editor, Fraser Nelson, to ask whether Project Fear will keep Britain in Europe. One story overshadowed politics this week, the death of David Bowie at the age of 69. But what was Bowie's legacy? In his column this week, Rod Little argues that it wasn't the attitude or the politics which made Bowie great, it was just that he wrote very good songs. Rod will be joining me, along with Kate Welsh, who says Bowie's rebellion against gender stereotypes made an impact on millions of lives. And finally, has Brighton gone bride's head? In this week's magazine, Julie Burchill says the city is suffering from an influx of posh students. Sussex University, once a hotbed of revolution, now has more than its fair share of over-entitled toffs, and they can make terrible neighbours. I'll be joined by Julie and by fellow Brighton resident Tim Stanley, who says the city's students are part of its charm. On to our first topic, Project Fear. I'm joined by James Forsyth and Fraser Nelson. James, Project Fear is normally associated with the Scottish referendum, but you're writing about a different vote in this week's magazine.
Yes, the EU referendum. I think when David Cameron announced in the Bloomberg speech back in 2013 that he was going to renegotiate Britain's terms of membership and then hold an in-out referendum, he said that the principal reason for Britain being in the EU was the single market. I think this referendum campaign will have a very different emphasis to that. You notice now that Cameron always talks about Europe being important to both our economic security and our national security. I think we're going to see a series of kind of technicolour warnings about the dangers of Britain leaving the EU. I think the question posed to voters will be in this scary, volatile world, do you really want Britain to go it alone?
Fraser Nelson, do you think Project Fear worked in the Scottish referendum? Obviously, Scotland didn't vote to leave Britain, but was it an effective campaigning tactic overall and for the long term?
Yes, it worked in the same way that chemotherapy works. Chemotherapy puts poison into your system and it kills, but it also has got horrible side effects. In Scotland, the negativity did win the day in the referendum, but the side effects were also poisonous. I mean, you've got a situation now where the SNP has had a relentlessly positive campaign, which in the end led Nicola Sturgeon to have this sensational result in last year's election, set to be repeated in this year's Scottish election. So the negativity was enough to get you through one referendum, but it still basically killed off the Labour Party as a result in Scotland. So it can work. I mean, all referenda basically are, do you want the risk of change or the status quo? If you look at the history of European referenda, the status quo almost always wins. I mean, in 1975, Britain was asked if it wants to stay in the EU, not to join the EU. And also, you know, in Cameron's brief experience with this, when he had all of these mayoral referenda saying, do you want mayors? All these cities who had a choice, almost all of them said no. So this is how you win a referendum. You highlight the risks, you try to terrify the bejesus out of voters. But I've always thought it's a very depressing way to win. I mean, I think very many Scots, Unionist Scots, were dismayed to see the argument for our incredible country reduced into a list of things that, oh, you're going to be too poor, too broke, too small to survive as an independent nation. I can't quite see those arguments being applied to Britain, but it's probably the most effective way of winning this referendum.
James, given the impact that the Project Fear in Scotland had on Scottish Labour, do you not think that there could be a similar impact on the Conservatives long term of such a negative campaign about Europe?
Well, apart from the fact that UKIP are certainly not the SNP. The SNP were a growing political force. I think UKIP are a force in decline. I think one of the interesting things about this Project Fear strategy is it actually recognises the limitations of the pro-EU argument. This is going to be a very odd referendum in that David Cameron is a self-described Eurosceptic who says that lots of Britain's success is down to staying outside the single currency and outside of Schengen. But he's then arguing to stay in the EU. I think one of the most interesting things is we were talking to a senior member of the government. They said, look, the economic arguments are actually now too finely balanced about in or out to be confident that the economics alone can win this. And that is why this security argument has been added to it. I think there is an interesting question here, though, which is the outcome are very confident that on the terrorism question, voters think that Europe is a hindrance rather than a help. They remember how difficult it was to get Abu Qatada out of a country, how difficult it was to get Abu Hamza out of a country, because of some combination of, you know, the European Court of Human Rights and EU law. So I think this referendum will be more interesting than people expect on this kind of turf. But I think the other thing is this: you always need a bit of emotion in politics, and Cameron himself has said he feels no emotional attachment to the EU. So the emotion that they're going to have to appeal to is going to have to be fear rather than hope or kind of some sense of European patriotism.
How easy is it for them to talk about security when, as you note in your column, David Cameron wasn't making that association himself only a few years ago, not going to celebrate the awarding of the Nobel Peace Prize to the European Union, for instance?
Well, this is the interesting thing about this. Is one of the many things that makes Britain an outlier in the EU is that for Britain this has always been a kind of purely economic argument, you know, which is that the costs outweigh the benefits, so we should be in the EU. Well, as for most of the rest of Europe, it has always been about geopolitics and security. You know, the former Eastern European countries see it as a guarantor against, you know, Russian domination returning. But countries in Europe that have come out of dictatorship, like Spain and Portugal and Greece, see it as, you know, a guarantor of their democracy. And obviously, for the original members, it's about not repeating the mistakes of World War II and World War I. So I think this is a change, because Britain has always seen NATO as security, while as the EU is about economics. So this is a very different argument. And this is one of the things I think is so fascinating, which is if they can win a referendum on this kind of security argument, you know, this country will have become a little bit more European.
And Fraser Nelson, is this not just a way of David Cameron accepting that he isn't going to bring anything particularly exciting back from his renegotiation, so he's going to scare people?
Well, yes, certainly. I mean, reading James's piece, it's quite clear that the only person who seems to be holding judgment on Cameron's renegotiation is Theresa May. She's keeping her powder dry, but everybody, including the Prime Minister, thinks, right, doesn't really matter what I do or don't get out of these negotiations. I've got no option but to campaign for in, and the campaigning is starting now. I mean, most political journalists can feel you can hear the noise. It's like an orchestra kind of tuning up. It doesn't really come up with a melody, but it's unmistakable. And you know they're preparing for an election this year because everybody's in election mode. The problem is, if we can hear this noise, they can hear it in Europe too. So when Cameron goes to say, I want you to give me a very good deal, or I might not recommend you to my people, they think, well, you're bluffing, Prime Minister. You're going to be forced to recommend this anyway. You're going to campaign. You're going to give it everything you've got. So why should we make concessions to you, given that we've effectively already won your vote? So this is what depresses me. I was one of those people who actually did rather believe in David Cameron's renegotiation. I thought there was a deal to be done if they were genuinely convinced that Brits might vote no. The problem with the EU is they only see the elites. They can only see Cameron. They struggle to see public opinion or to fear public opinion. And I think in behaving this way, Cameron is really rapidly undermining his own chances of getting a good deal from Europe.
And James, what sort of timetable are we now expecting for the conclusion of the renegotiation and the referendum?
Well, I think Cameron would like to kind of wrap up a deal in February and then hold the referendum in June. I personally think that timetable is almost certain to slip, because we haven't had any of the kind of technical discussions yet. You know, I mean, the idea that there is still sufficient distance, I think, from an agreement, that it's hard to imagine that one dinner will be able to come to an agreement at the February summit. But it is quite clear that Cameron would like this year. I think one thing to watch, though, is that the International Rescue Committee has said that there's been no pause in the number of migrants coming to Europe this winter. But, you know, the normal drop-off that you get as the weather gets colder and the seas get choppier hasn't happened. I wonder if there's another flare-up of the migrant crisis, whether they don't decide to hold back on the referendum this year. So I think they definitely want a referendum in 2016. But I wouldn't be... One member of the political cabinet suggested to me that although the government is gearing up for a 2016 referendum, it might end up being in March 2017, despite that not being what Cameron wants.
Fraser Nelson, you think that Britain will vote to stay in the EU?
Right now, I think it's more likely than not. I mean, I always look at the bookmakers rather than the opinion polls. And the bookmakers say there's about a 35% chance of Britain exiting. But things can change. If you compare this referendum to previous referenda, it's a lot more like the Scottish one. The gap seems to be narrowing and a lot can go wrong. I mean, right now, you just need to turn on the television to see examples of what's happening in Europe. I mean, now we're learning about this Swedish crisis, which we're writing about in the magazine this week, where it turns out that this practice of young immigrant men harassing women has been going on in Sweden as well as Cologne. And stories like this just seem to accumulate, and they seem to paint a picture of the EU project going badly wrong. Now, if this sort of pace of bad news continues, then things might look very different by the time we have the referendum. I think James is right that September, realistically, is the earliest David Cameron can do it. But if it does get pushed into next year, then we might have a financial crisis built upon the immigration crisis. So I really do think there is all to play for.
And James, in your column, just finally, you report that Obama is making a visit this spring. What difference would that make to the renegotiation and to the result?
Well, I mean, President Obama is expected to come this spring, and I think the people in government circles are quite hopeful about this, because Obama has already made clear that he would like Britain to stay in the EU. And I think they hope that having the American president endorse EU membership will give the In campaign a boost, and they also hope it will show that there's no contradiction between the special relationship between Britain and the US and EU membership. And also it will reinforce this security point. If the president, the leader of the free world, wants the UK to remain in the EU for the West's common security, that kind of bolsters this argument that, you know, the people who'd be most delighted if we left would be the Russians and Putin and, you know, other villains in the world.
On to our second topic, David Bowie's legacy. I'm joined by Rod Liddell and Kate Welsh. Rod, you say in your column in The Spectator this week that the most important thing about David Bowie was, quite simply, the songs.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, an awful lot's been written about him in the last few days, so much that I'm beginning, very sadly indeed, to get a bit sick of it all. I think he was an exceptionally gifted songwriter with a great melodic imagination. I think that's why he endured, because the songs he wrote had, for rock music, unusual chord sequences and choruses which came out of nowhere and suddenly hit you. And I think all the stuff about him being a chameleon, for example, that's the thing we kept hearing. I think Piers Morgan was the first to tweet, "He was a chameleon," and everyone else came, "Yes, he was a chameleon." Well, yeah, all right, loads of rock musicians change their image from time to time. It's no use if they don't have any good songs. The glory of Bowie over six or seven albums between 1970 and 1978 was just exceptionally good songwriting.
Kate, do you think there's more to Bowie than just his music?
Absolutely. I mean, there's no denying that he was an incredibly, incredibly gifted musician. But it's easy to say that his influence as a role model for example, LGBT people, it's easy to say that that's unimportant when most of music, film and TV look and act just like you. There's been a flood of comments and think pieces and tweets from lesbian women, gay women, trans women, you know, the entire LGBT spectrum, talking about how important he was, how much he saved their lives. He reflected an image back of people who didn't see themselves anywhere else at the time, especially not on Top of the Pops or becoming a global superstar. And if you don't see that, then you still have his music. One doesn't detract from the other. Nobody can argue that he isn't being lauded as one of the finest musicians of the 20th and 21st century right now. But he kept reinventing himself, and there's enough Bowie for everybody to have seconds.
And for those of us who might not be particularly familiar with David Bowie, save for the occasional song on the radio, can you just explain what it was that he did that helped so many LGBT people?
I mean, there's so much. He was going on Top of the Pops wearing full makeup to the extent that nobody knew if he was a man or if he was a woman. And the beautiful thing was, it didn't matter. He was appearing in photo shoots and on record covers in dresses at a time when, you know, it's still difficult for men to do that. He came out as bisexual, then as gay, and then as straight. He really, it's not so much a case of reinvented himself, but I think kept rediscovering himself in a way that really resonates for a lot of people in my community.
Rod Liddell, don't you think that's just irrelevant and lots of other artists were doing that anyway? Or do you think there's actually something in what Kate's just said?
Oh, I think there's something in it. But he certainly wasn't the first pop musician to celebrate androgyny, not by a very, very long chalk. I mean, Mick Jagger was doing it a long time before Bowie. And doing it in quite an outrageous manner as well. My objection is that given that chap has died, he's suddenly shoehorned into various sort of political agendas, and various other parts of his politics are of course conveniently forgotten. So we hear a lot about him. He wasn't a campaigner for gay, bi, or transgendered rights. He may have shown that image on stage as part of the various characters who he invented, but he didn't do the sort of campaigning which you know the people like Peter Tatchell, Harvey Milk, and so on did throughout their lives. And I think it's wrong to sort of co-opt him as a sort of voice of LGBT rights. You know, there are other things about Bowie which have been conveniently forgotten. You know, his support for fascism, for example, his denunciation of the morality, the decadent morality of the United Kingdom and the United States. Neither of those two statements seem to me terribly LGBT-friendly. I mean, the man was in many ways a contradiction, both in how he acted and what he said.
Kate, have you forgotten some bits of David Bowie's attitude towards society?
Oh, I wish I could. I mean, I think for what it's worth, a lot of the explicitly fascist stuff he came out with, he did retract. He did say that...
He really didn't, you know. He really didn't. He retracted a comment he made about Adolf Hitler a bit. Mm. He said he wasn't up to his usual standard in the interview. But he continued to say over a period of 2 or 3 years, possibly presaging Thatcher in a way, because this was round about 1975. He arrived back in Great Britain and saw it strike-ridden and grey and dull and nothing seems to work. He said that you needed a right-wing front to clean everything up for a bit. In a way, that was presaging Thatcher, I think, though it's a bit unkind on Thatcher, who wasn't quite as right-wing as Bowie might have hinted, even though she did cause enormous destruction to working-class communities. But... you know, his politics weren't that simple. It's the same with Mick Jagger, in a way. You know, everyone always co-opted Mick Jagger as a lefty, whereas actually he was quite sort of conservative in many, many ways.
Absolutely. But I think it's important that, you know, I mean, I speak as a left-wing writer myself, we don't get a monopoly on role models in that sense, even if it was all just one big glorious performance. And I think every iteration of Bowie was one glorious performance. That level of gender fluidity, the playing around with sexuality, he wasn't the first. He wasn't certainly even the bravest. He wasn't a pioneer in the way that maybe he's being portrayed at the moment, but he was still a terrifically important figure to be doing that. And I think if the basic human right to see somebody who reflects your own experiences back at you is political, we're not the ones who made it that way.
Yeah, I can see that. I can agree with most of that. And indeed, you know, I can remember seeing him exactly the same time I was watching as Boy George was watching Top of the Pops in 1972 when Starman came on. And I can remember my father looking at the television and saying, and I'm afraid you'll have to excuse me for this, what the fucking hell is that? this was the view of Middlesbrough in 1972. And I found it incredibly exciting, just as Boy George did. Thankfully, I didn't take the same decision as Boy George and become a pop musician.
There's still time, Rod.
I could still do that, I suppose, couldn't I? Yeah.
And one of the things you say, Rod, in your column is that you haven't heard so much imbecilic, repetitive guff since Nelson Mandela died in the outpouring of grief at David Bowie's death. It sounds as though you've been quite surprised at how much coverage and how much has been written about Bowie.
Oh, I think that's today, isn't it? It's the way we are today. There's a sob fest at every possible occasion. And incidentally, that wasn't a dig at Nelson Mandela. I said exactly the same thing when Margaret Thatcher died. It's something which the media, and we're to blame for it, we're to blame largely for it. It's very easy to do, and so we do it. We pile in with eulogies, with interminable thousand-word pieces about how great these people were, and we rather elevate them above even what they achieved in their lives. You know, it's hard to say that about Mandela, I suppose, but I think we did do that. You know, and we're certainly doing it with David Bowie. This sort of sobbing grief mentality, which seems to have had its roots in the death of Princess Diana. That seems to be when it all started, this sort of over-the-top emoting. You know, I played a few David Bowie songs when I heard the guy had died because, you know, I liked and respected him and felt very sad. But I think the candlelit vigil's taken it a bit far, that's all.
Kate, have you been to any candlelit vigils?
I haven't, no, although I am going to see a showing of the film Labyrinth, which, you know, as a dreaded millennial, that was my first exposure to David Bowie, was when he was playing the Goblin King. So I'm going to see that on Saturday. But I think it's important, as Rod says, not to elevate even, you know, important cultural figures like Bowie, and to gloss over the deeply, deeply problematic aspects of him. He did help pave the way with his gender fluidity, with playing around with sexuality. But he was also very much a product of his time. You know, we've touched on his less than savoury political views. There are discussions happening. I've seen a lot online about the fact that he was sleeping with underage, I guess, groupies, much as, sadly, so many people did at the time. It's important that we don't whitewash him or gloss over who he was to make him who we want him to be.
No, I think that's absolutely right. And I have to say, on the sleeping with underage people, I don't want to libel an entire nation, but my suspicion is that back in that day, you know, particularly around glam rock time, but also earlier and also afterwards, my guess is that very few bands wouldn't have taken advantage of underage girls who turned up at their concerts. I think it was a product of the time. And there's also the drugs, of course. You know, the drugs weren't good. And it undoubtedly, I mean, that's another way in which he possibly did influence people, although not individually, but as part of that entire tranche of rock music, where it was seen as being this rather glorious thing to take large quantities of drugs, this rebellious notion that it was anti-authoritarian, that it was something that your parents didn't want you to do and the government didn't want you to do, and therefore it was okay. And, you know, that lasted for an awful long time. It's probably still going on now.
A reminder of our special subscription offer for listeners of The View from 22. For just £22, you can receive a 22-week subscription to The Spectator in the post, along with access to our website, iPad, iPhone and Android apps. Sign up to read all the articles discussed in this podcast at spectator.co.uk/22. On to our third topic, Brighton Goes Brideshead. I'm joined by Julie Birchall and Tim Stanley. Julie, in this week's magazine, you talk about the problems with Brighton, particularly students who seem to be rampaging up and down the streets and swearing at various friends of yours. Can you say a little bit more about how this has developed over the last few years?
Yes. My husband, who's lived here since he was a child, says that Brighton was always a very mixed town. But over the past maybe 5 years, it's become immensely posh. And the voices have got posher and posher to an almost parodic degree, and was recently coming back on the train from London, and there were an immense bunch of posh girls, and one of them actually said the words, "Have you been to Brick Lane Market? It's really cool." Which is, I didn't put in the piece because it would seem beyond parody. And these kids are okay when they hang around by themselves, but what they've started to do recently is move into residential streets on the outskirts of Brighton and make life an absolute misery for the non-student residents of these streets, which last month culminated in a full-on pitch battle in my best friend's street, which ended up in the newspapers and the police coming and people in A&E and all that.
Is this really just a problem with Brighton, or is it more of a problem with students? When I was a student at Exeter University, for instance, our newspaper covered a case of some rugby boys jumping up and down on the roofs of cars and urinating on people's cats. So is it not just a problem with every university town? Or do you think there's a specific problem with Brighton?
I think because Brighton's so close to London, we probably have a more extreme version of it. And because Sussex University is very social, but I dare say it goes on all over the country. I'm not saying students making noise is a bad thing. I mean, dogs are going to bark and students are going to have parties. But it's the things that they actually said to my friend and her daughter when they confronted them. Such lovely bonbons is, what are you qualified for? Working at Morrison's? What will you amount to, you lower class slag? So how do you think you're speaking to? We're students, we can do what we like. And the best one was, this is a student street now, move out if you don't like the noise. So it's basically students attempting a type of ethnic cleansing.
I'm a bit more sympathetic towards students because, for instance, one night coming home, this is a very Brighton story, my key just randomly snapped off in the lock, which just says a lot about, you know, Brighton housing.
You've all been there.
And it was 11:30 at night. It was freezing cold. I had no idea what to do. And there was a student party going on two houses down. So I knocked on the window and said, can I come in? And because they were students and drunk, they said yes. And I stayed with them until 3 or 4 in the morning. And so on that occasion, students, I think, saved my life. I do understand how having a lot of students together can be rowdy and difficult. I think that's not necessarily the fault of students. I think it's a sort of reflection on the changing class dynamic in British society. I really do recognise that picture of Brighton as becoming far too upscale and far too posh.
Yeah.
It was always a working class, small C conservative town with a strong gay element, a strong avant-garde element. And in recent years, it's become a satellite town for London. And a lot of very posh people have realised they could save £100,000 to £200,000 on their mortgage by moving down to the coast and be near the sea.
Yeah.
And I think there's a wider ethnic cleansing going on that isn't just students. I think Brighton as a whole and lots of other towns like that, Hastings will be next. It's already happening to Margate. I think even places like Deal have started to go that way. All these seaside towns are being taken over by poshos moving from London. And that's what really worries me, rather than the 19-year-olds with their loud music and their dope and the such.
Is that not a good thing, ultimately, for a town, though, if you're talking about towns like Margate and other coastal towns, which are often in the headlines because of their local economies being very weak? Is it not good that you've got those with loads of money moving to the town and potentially spending quite a lot of that there?
They're good in small numbers and they're good in season. But Brighton is so much more than a satellite of London. It's got real character and it's got massive working class enclaves, which are far livelier than anything these milk-fed students could ever dream of. And it is a sleazy town, and I do object to the good, honest sleaze of Brighton being replaced by some dumb, posh person's idea of what's wild. My husband calls them the Dharma Plums because they think they're like Jack Kerouac's Dharma Bones. They've all got dream catchers over their beds. But they're tremendously entitled, probably even more than their parents. And this bohemian thing is just a momentary carapace which will come off when they go into the workplace. And it's slightly annoying to see them swagger around as though they've just discovered Brighton and they're bringing something special to it. This is a very odd, sleazy place.
I agree with that, and I just want to add that something that really saddens me is the decline of the good old-fashioned sex shop. Brighton used to have loads of shops where there would be a big heavy curtain on the front window.
Private shop,
and it used to have XXX above the door, and they've all gone. What can be done about it? I don't think anything can be done about it. You can't stop this kind of progress. I'm so conservative. I'd quite like the government somehow to freeze Britain as it is, sort of stick it in the freezer so that nothing ever changes and areas retain and remain exactly they were as I remember them and love them. But that's never going to happen. I don't think you can do anything about it.
I think
just enforce the law. That would be one good place to start.
I think the government should bring in a PQ, which is a posh quotient, and only a certain number of posh students are allowed to go to a university because they do ruin the neighbourhood.
And that's it for this week's episode. Thank you to all of our guests for joining, and thank you for listening.
Gary, Winston Wolf, direct line. The landlord Mike says you wrecked this place.
Wait,
knocking holes in the walls. And all that graffiti? Fancy yourself an artiste?
No.
But it's all covered, Gary. Mike is with direct line. They'll cover up to the full amount insured for malicious damage by tenants.
Oh, good. Can I go now?
Oh, no, Gary. Direct Line's looking after Mike, but who's looking after you?
Direct Line Landlord Insurance covers up to the sum insured for malicious damage by tenants. Can your landlord insurance do that? Search Direct Line Landlord. Optional extra qualifying criteria and excess apply. Underwritten by UK Insurance Limited.